Today is Wednesday, March 29th. We're going to work on the rest of metabolism today and start urinary system. So I'd like to start you back by talking about the way we deal with glucose. We know that glucose levels need to be maintained, and we do that using two short-term hormones, insulin and glucagon. So if we have high blood sugar, say above our normal range of 70 to 120 units per deciliter of blood, then we're going to store the excess glucose as glycogen. Where are some places you might store glucose as glycogen? Liver, muscles, good. And we typically store glycogen for a few days, and then after that we turn it into fat. What is the name of the hormone that stores glucose as glycogen? Insulin, right? Good. So insulin is going to store glucose as glycogen. And there's a fancy word that explains the storage process. It's called glycogenesis. You know, this word is tricky. It's got the word glycogen in there and the word genesis in there. But instead of memorizing the term and getting confused, I think the easiest thing to say is, okay, let's break the word down. Glycogen and genesis in there tell us we're making or building glycogen. And so if we think or work that through, of course, glycogen is built from building blocks called glucose, and we know that insulin drives the process of turning extra glucose into glycogen. So, you know, if you go to Krispy Kreme, they got the hot now sign flash, and you stop and you get yourself a dozen hot donuts, it's hard to resist, so you eat a bunch of donuts. Now your blood sugar is in excess of 120 units per deciliter, and after a few hours, your insulin will have turned a lot of that extra glucose into glycogen for storage. Let's say the next day that you're really busy, you don't have an opportunity to get up and eat anything or drink much, so your body is kind of running on yesterday's fuel. So now you're going to go in and tap those glycogen supplies. When you're looking for energy, you first burn through your available glucose, and then you come after your storage of glycogen. So where do we go to burn off that glycogen? Muscles, yeah. Liver and muscles have that glycogen. Now, which hormone is going to raise blood glucose levels over the short term? Glucagon. Good. So glucagon comes back, and it says, let's break down that glycogen into glucose. And it's going to do this as long as you're in a deficit, helping to raise your blood glucose levels. Now, this particular process is called glycogenolysis. Literally break it down again. Glycogen and lysis means to break down glycogen. And our job here is to raise blood sugar levels.
You said that's short term?
That's short term, that's right. As you continue to burn through your glycogen supplies, you may eventually exhaust your glycogen supplies, and after that point, you need another energy source to tap into. So now, what do we break down? Fats and proteins, good. Okay, so those fats and proteins are going to be broken down. But we're going to assist the breakdown process with a different hormone. This one's called what? Cortisol. Yep, cortisol is the one. Cortisol comes along and says, all right, fats and proteins, you get broken down into glycogen and then ultimately into glucose. Now, we have a name for this process called gluconeogenesis. And I use the word neo as my reminder that we're getting sugar from a non-carbohydrate source, okay? So cortisol drives this process. And keep in mind, neo tells us we're getting sugar from a new non-carbohydrate source. If you're going to lose weight, that's the way it works. You have to burn through your glucose supplies first. Once you hit a critically low level, your body then starts burning off your glycogen supplies. And then over the long term, you need to start burning off fats, preferably not proteins, but you can burn off those fats and lose weight. And so cortisol helps to make that transition. So this is how blood sugar is maintained. We've got a bunch of hormones here that work together. We know there's other players in this cycle. We know epinephrine and growth hormone also influence blood sugar levels, but these are the primary ones that help to maintain blood sugar. So we just got through talking about digestion and appetite and gastrin and ghrelin. These hormones actually play a role there. We just don't involve them in the conversation. Do y'all have questions on how this whole cycle works? So that should take us down to the bottom of page 98. Let's take a look at lipids on the top of page 99. So, you know, we often hear about lipids and fats as having a bad reputation. We often think about them as being something that we should not be getting in our diets, but certainly they're very important for building things like plasma membrane structures. So we do need them, we just need certain types and we need them in moderation. Your typical fat is composed of a glycerol head, and we need, of course, three fatty acid chains to make a triglyceride. So those are the typical building blocks of our fats. We know steroids are a little different. Steroids don't have the typical building blocks. They are instead formed from four fused carbon rings. Some books don't even put steroids with the other fats because they've got a completely different structure. But nonetheless, this textbook, like many others, do classify steroids like cholesterol and estrogen, testosterone, as your typical lipid or fat. So I want to tell you a little bit about fats. You know, way back when you studied fats and water in Bio-210, you learned about how they did not get along. That's because water is polar and fats are mostly what? Nonpolar, yeah. And what is the relationship between polar and nonpolar? They don't mix, they don't go together. So if you're gonna transport fats in the bloodstream, you have to give them a protein to transport them. And the protein that transport them is called a lipoprotein. So these lipoproteins hook onto our fats and then they haul them around our bloodstream. So it's kind of an interesting concept that, you know, fats aren't just floating by themselves. Fats are floating in conjunction with those proteins that they're bound to. We've got two types of lipoproteins that transport fats. We've got high-density lipoproteins called HDLs, and we've got low-density lipoproteins called LDLs. So we basically divide these two in the direction they transport the protein or the lipids. HDLs are transporting those lipids toward the liver to be broken down and included as part of bile. Okay, so why is that a good thing to put fat in the bile? Yeah, so it can be broken down. And where does bile get sent? From the liver to the small intestine, right. It is not restored once it's sent there. It is sent from the small intestine to emulsify what?
Fats,
good. And then once you digest your food, it is passed out of your body with your feces. You can say goodbye to the lipids that were transported to your liver by your HDLs. So we think of the H as being helpful in addition to being a high-density lipid or high-density lipoprotein. These LDLs are considered lousy. That's what a lot of people say that L stands for. These are bad lipoproteins because they're transporting our lipids out to our cells and tissues. So I kind of think of them like airheads. They're taking along these lipids and they say, oops, I lost that one, oh, whatever, and they keep on floating. And the problem is if you lose your lipids in your bloodstream, the lipids just stay there like, what am I supposed to do? Oh, I know, I'll just clog up this vessel. And so if your lipids are being transported by a lipoprotein and they get lost along the way, now we have an opportunity for vessels to become clogged with plaque and cholesterol and all that stuff that can cause blockages. So LDLs are considered bad because they're actually taking lipids in the wrong direction to build those cells and tissues. And so it gives us the opportunity for peripheral artery disease, something called PAD. So This may be a way to remember it. H is helpful, L is lousy, and that's based on the direction that these lipoproteins are being traveling to transport those lipids. Do you have any questions so far on HDLs versus LDLs? Okay. So atherosclerosis is typically the result of having lost a bunch of those lipids in the bloodstream. What happens to our vessels during atherosclerosis?
They harden.
They harden, yes. So over time you get an end stage of the disease called arteriosclerosis, and that can come from a diet high in fats like cholesterol. It can also come from your genetics, which is very difficult to control. In fact, only around 15% of your own cholesterol comes from your diet. The other 85% comes from your genes. So it is difficult to control, you know, how much fat or cholesterol we're transporting. So let's talk about fat catabolism. Does catabolism mean we're breaking down fats or building them? Breaking them down. Okay. So when you break down a fat, you can do so through gluconeogenesis. That helps us to make glucose or fuel. And when we break them down, that glycerol head is actually going to be converted to glucose. We'll in turn use that glucose for energy. Now, this is a dirty process. It is not a clean and efficient way to make ATP. What is the link between glucose and ATP? Glucose is used to make aerobic cellular respiration run in the presence of oxygen. And what's the end product? ATP, yeah, around 34 to 36. So if you're trying to make ATP through this mechanism, it's not very clean, because what you end up doing is making these ketone bodies, these nasty little results that come off the process of processing these fats, and that can be problematic for us. But nonetheless, you can turn glucose, or can turn fats rather, into glucose by breaking down those fatty acid glycerol, those glycerol heads preferably. Let's talk about proteins. They're over on the next page. We'll talk about ketoacidosis with them as well. We know proteins are built from amino acids. That is the building block for our proteins. There's about 20 different amino acids that combine to form our proteins. 8 of them are essentials. The other 12 there are considered non-essential. Those 8 essentials must be obtained through your diet. And those foods that you take in must contain a combination of those amino acids, since you can't make them on your own. Most animal products provide you with all 8 essential amino acids. There, you have to play the game right to get it from plant groups, but a combination of rice and beans can give you all 8 amino acids in that essential category. Proteins can also break down to form glycogen, and from glycogen we can take it a step further and form glucose, which hormone drives that process? Glycogen to glucose is glucagon, and the whole process of getting here is driven by cortisol. So cortisol plays this to a certain point, and then glucagon finishes the process of breaking glycogen into glucose. So both proteins and fats can ultimately be broken down to form glucose. Both are kind of a dirty process. They're not a clean, efficient process. And the problem is we can form these byproducts called ketone bodies by doing this. Ketone bodies can help acidify your bloodstream, and ketone bodies can give us a condition called ketoacidosis. Now you've got the stimulus, right? If you're in ketoacidosis, what may happen to your respiration rate? Increases, right. So this may happen if you're breaking down proteins and or fats. Ketoacidosis can modify your blood pH and in turn modify your heart rate, your pressure, and your respiration rate. Okay, so I want to mention ketone bodies because if you're dieting, that's what you want to have in your urine and your bloodstream. It indicates you're doing what? Burning the fat, right. So ketone bodies for a person who is dieting is good news. That's what you want to have. However, if you're a diabetic and you have ketone bodies present in your blood or your urine, what does that mean you're breaking down? Right, proteins, right. So unfortunately for a diabetic who has ketone bodies present, it may mean you're losing weight, but it's not the kind of weight you want to lose. Nobody needs to break down healthy protein matter, and that may be in fact what's happening. So a person who is in ketoacidosis and diabetic most likely has a blood sugar issue at that time. They're probably having high blood sugar levels, and that could be a problem for, you know, maintaining normal blood sugar. So this is something to kind of consider, that those ketone bodies can be tattletales on what type of sugar we're getting, whether it's from glycogen or from, say, fats and proteins. How about questions on pages 99 or 100? So if you've never smelled a person with ketoacidosis, their breath smells like acetone. Acetone is fingernail polish remover, and once you've smelled ketoacidotic breath, it's unlike any other breath you've ever smelled. It's not like having bad breath, it's like having some kind of strange chemical odor coming out. Any of y'all ever smelled a person with ketoacidosis? Yeah. So kind of a bizarre, it's like a mixture of fruit juice and alcohol or acetone. It's a really odd smell. All right, so on to the vitamins. They are last in this chapter. They're page 101. So at the top of your page, you'll notice that vitamins are not made for the body except for a few B vitamins, D and K. We make B vitamins in our large intestine. We need B vitamins for a variety of reasons. We'll go through some of those. Where do you make vitamin D? Skin, good. Vitamin K is also made by your large intestine and absorbed into your bloodstream. So we can make a few vitamins, we just can't make all the vitamins. The fat solubles you'll want to know as ADEC. Those are the A, D, E, and K vitamins. Water solubles are B and C. So which one of these do you think we should take with food if you're taking supplements? ADEC, right. ADEC should be taken with food because they are fat soluble. We should also take vitamin B12 with food. Why is that? What do you need to absorb vitamin B12? Intrinsic factor, yeah. Where is intrinsic factor made? Stomach. Yeah, absorbed in the small intestine but made in the stomach. And intrinsic factor is only made when you're preparing to eat or currently eating. So if you take vitamin B12 on an empty stomach, you're not going to maximize the absorption rate. I did want to mention that we can store some of these vitamins. The ones that we can store are the ADEC fat-soluble vitamins. These can actually lead to a case of hypervitaminosis, meaning excess vitamins in the body. So because they're fat-soluble, we can store these in our fatty tissues or in our liver. It is rare for us to have a vitamin deficiency of this group. It is rare for us to not have enough of the A, D, E, and K, since they can be stored in our fatty tissues. So let's take, go ahead, Kayla.
What did you say about B12 and K?
B12 is made in it's partly made in the large intestine. You can also absorb it through the lining of your small intestine when you eat foods that contain it, but you've got to have intrinsic factor for its absorption. No, just for B12. So vitamin A is called beta-carotene. What kind of food groups have beta-carotene? Carrots, sweet potatoes. So yellow stuff, orange stuff like squash, pumpkin, sweet potatoes, carrots. Those yellow to orange colored vegetables have beta-carotene or vitamin A. We've always heard eat your carrots, they make your eyes, you know, strong. And of course, it's because rods need vitamin A to properly be able to see at night. If you have an honest-to-goodness vitamin A deficiency, you may have night blindness. But, you know, why would night blindness be rare? It's stored in the fat, right. So most likely we're going to have enough vitamin A from our fatty tissues to make your rods be able to function properly. So yeah, vitamin A deficiencies are rare because, again, it's a fat-soluble vitamin and we do tend to store it in our fatty tissues. So I gave you a blank there for food sources. I'm not going to ask you that on the test. It's just kind of an FYI for you. But, you know, orange and yellow vegetables are good sources of vitamin A. So you may know somebody, or you yourself may have done this, if you enjoy eating orange-colored vegetables, you can eat them to the point of pigmenting your skin. And of course, anytime you pigment your skin from the inside out, you're looking at 2 to 4 weeks' time for replacement of that old skin. So yeah, you may be orange for about 2 to 4 weeks while that skin grows out. So, you know, little kids love to obsess over a food, and if you obsess over carrots, there you go, you can stain yourself orange from the inside out. That's just a case of hypervitaminosis with vitamin A. Vitamin D we can make in the presence of sunlight. We can also get it from dairy products. And vitamin D we know is important for helping to regulate calcium and phosphorus storage to the bones. Without having adequate levels of calcium and phosphorus, our bones are weak and more likely to flex under the body's weight. You know, back in Bio210, you may have heard a discussion of this stuff. Rickets can form from a lack of vitamin D in kids, and in adults, we call that disorder osteomalacia. So really important for us to have adequate levels of vitamin D. So sunlight is certainly a source for us. Milk products, even some green leafy vegetables have some vitamin D. So these are women with rickets. You know, during the childhood years, if you don't have adequate levels of vitamin D, or if you have some type of metabolism problem where you can't properly convert vitamin D into calcitriol, then a person may have soft, weak bones that bow under the body's weight. I don't mean to imply that anybody with bowed legs has rickets, but, you know, especially in times before, you know, the current, you know, era, a lot of times people were malnourished for various reasons, and bowed legs could have been a vitamin D deficiency or metabolism issue. And so that's what it looks like there. You've got quite a bowed-looking femur on this x-ray. Osteomalacia can occur later in life. You know, it becomes harder to get vitamin D into the body if people don't spend enough sunlight hours or if they are not getting it in their diet. So osteomalacia may set up in later life. So let's talk about vitamin E. Vitamin E is another one of those fat-soluble vitamins. We need it for immune function. We also need it as an antioxidant. So I know you've probably heard the word antioxidant thrown around quite often. This particular term is a chemical that helps us to repair cells after cellular respiration products damage them. So when you think of an antioxidant, think of something that helps to repair damaged cells. You'll notice the sources of vitamin E are oils, you know, something like, you know, peanut oil, for instance, green leafy vegetables, tomatoes and pumpkin also contain vitamin E. And again, vitamin deficiencies for E are rare. Why is that? Fat-soluble. Yep. So ADEC or fat-soluble deficiencies are rare. So our last fat-soluble, excuse me, pollen's getting me today, fat-soluble vitamin is K, and K is an important one we know for blood clot. So you can make vitamin K by your large intestine. You have naturally present bacteria in your large intestine that can manufacture vitamin K. In fact, what kinds of foods contain vitamin K that your bacteria can use to make it? Vegetables, yeah. Especially things like they're in the bean family. You know, beans give us a lot of gas. That's when those bacteria are making vitamin K from those enriched vegetables. So the next time you've got gas, you can just tell people you're making vitamin K, you know, making those bacteria happy. So the process involves bacteria transforming those nutrients into vitamin K. Green leafy vegetables also have vitamin K in them as well. Things like spinach and kale are great sources of vitamin K. And so the issue here is if you have a deficiency of vitamin K, you may have impaired blood clotting. For people who take antibiotics, maybe a long-term course of antibiotics, we kill off the bacteria in our intestines, and we reduce the opportunities for making vitamin K. So if you reduce the opportunity for vitamin K, what happens to you? Bleed easier. Yes, if people bleed easier, they bruise easier. So vitamin K is going to be one of those components that helps stop the clotting process. You know, stops you from bleeding, so to speak. So kind of an interesting connection there between the intestines, bacteria, and the foods that you eat. So let's talk about some water-soluble vitamins. We know the B and C vitamins fall into this category. The only one of this that we tend to store is vitamin B12 and a little bit of vitamin C, but really that's it. The rest of these B and C vitamins are washed through in your interstitial fluids and flushed out. Okay, so B12 and C we store to some extent, and that's about it. Don't worry about the alternate names here. B1 is alternately known as thiamine. I will give you the alternate name on the test if we're talking about B1, okay? And this particular one is found in meat products like pork, yeast, which is used to make breads, and cereals, so whole grain products and cereals. So most likely you're getting B1 from some source here. Since most people eat a variety of foods, you're most likely going to get enough B1 in your diet. People who tend to have B1 deficiencies are those who can't eat or don't eat or have some problems absorbing nutrients from their intestines. And so beriberi disease, you'll notice here, common in alcoholics, gastric bypass, or those who eat unenriched rice. And this is what beriberi looks like. It is a muscle wasting disease. It results in central nervous system damage. And basically it's what happens when you're not getting enough of that B1 nutrient. Your body tends to deteriorate and break down. So this does not look like a compatible list for life, and eventually beriberi disease can kill a person. I want to tell you the history of this. Back in the late 1800s, people started realizing they could improve the shelf life of foods by modifying the way that they store them. And so when we look at rice has a husk on it, and that husk contains an oil. If you shell that husk off of the rice grain, you can keep rice in your cabinet for months, right? You probably have rice in your cabinets that's been there for quite a long time. And so that maintains shelf stability. One of the things they realized when they started taking the husks off of rice is, hey, great shelf stability, but then they started having people with this disorder. And so what came about was enriched rice. You'll notice on the product here, it does say enriched, and in fact, it is enriched with vitamin B1. Now, this is not something they discovered overnight. They first discovered that they can increase shelf stability by removing that oily husk. And then it took in some cases, with these products here, 20 to 50 years to realize that what they had done to increase stability actually caused disease. So then they started re-enriching these products late 1800s and early 1900s. So nowadays, you know, go to the grocery store, all your rice products will say enriched. They have had the husk removed, and they've got, you know, an enrichment of vitamin B1 added back in to give you the vitamin that you need. B2 is called, Caleb, do you have a question? It is probably some chemical wash process. I don't know how they do that enrichment, but rice, corn, goodness, pretty much every grain that we eat is going to be enriched back with vitamins. Riboflavin is B2, and this one is important for enzymes and for other vitamins to be able to work. We get this from a lot of different food groups, everything from milk, eggs, cheese, vegetables, organ meats like liver and kidneys from other animals, even yeast and mushrooms and almonds. So there's a whole bunch of foods here that you can get vitamin B2 from. Again, because most of us eat a variety of foods, it is unlikely that we're going to have a B2 deficiency, even though we don't store this one. And if you do have a deficiency, we get cracked skin, especially at the corners of the mouth, and dermatitis, which, you know, is skin inflammation. So if you'd like to copy some of those food sources, I'll give you all a moment. I didn't give you a very big box, did I? You can put about two foods in there and that's it. Okay, anyone else still need the screen? All right. And the same story goes here. Back in the 1800s, they started realizing they could make flour last a lot longer by removing the oils from it, from the wheat grains. So again, that's gonna remove the B2 vitamin, and they re-enrich the flour with B2 or thiamine, riboflavin, and that way, of course, we get the B2 that we need in our bodies. So every flour bag in the grocery store nowadays probably says on the front, enriched. So that's what they mean, is they've re-added back the B2 vitamin that they took out to make that have a longer shelf life. All right, and so this is what we see with B2 deficiencies. You'll notice the cracked corners of the lips. You know, some people get this in the wintertime with dry skin. This is not dry skin. This is an actual vitamin deficiency. And in some cases, we see other things like, you know, chafed hands, really bad dermatitis or inflammation of the skin. B3 is called niacin, and this particular one is often found in bread groups. You'll notice seeds there that we use to make breads is a good source of it. Beer, oddly enough, is a good source for vitamin B3. Meat, egg, fruit, vegetables. So there's a lot of places where you're going to likely get this one from. The disorder here is called pellagra, and it results in four D's. You'll notice they are dermatitis or skin inflammation, diarrhea, dementia, and death. And again, people who either can't eat or won't eat or have some kind of absorptive issue are going to end up with this particular disorder. So again, go ahead, Anthony.
Why do we need it?
We need this one. Oh, I left you a blank there, didn't I? This one is used for like enzymes, like with B2. They assist with other vitamins and how they function. A lot of this stuff is at the chemical level. It's not something we really go into depths with. So again, this one often comes from seeds like corn, and again, they shelled it in such a way to remove the vitamin. Now again, you know, now today they have all these products enriched with vitamin B3. So again, it is all about shelf life versus consumer health. This one actually had a huge impact on the state of South Carolina, because what do Southerners love to eat? Grits. Yeah, cornbread, grits, corn products is a staple of the South. And unfortunately, a lot of people in this state
had a huge issue with vitamin B3 deficiency. If I remember correctly, it's something like 30 or 40 years before they finally made the connection between the hull removal for the corn and the pellagra disease. You'll notice that we didn't start enriching corn until 1937. They had started removing the hull back in the 1800s. So very long time, a lot of people were starving and had a lot of malnutrition since corn is such a staple of many diets. So this is pellagra, you know, diarrhea, dementia, death results from this one. You notice his hands here. That is inflammation with pellagra. So again, it's from malnutrition. That's what comes with this one. B9 is one that we often hear about. Its alternate name is folic acid. We need this one for red blood cell production. We also need this one for the growth of the spinal cord and the nervous system. And this one's commonly found in whole grains and cereals. If you're a female who has started menstruating until the time that you stop menstruating later in life, they will push vitamin B9, folic acid, because by the time most females realize they're pregnant, they have already missed the stage when the fetus develops its spinal cord. So the spinal cord development relies on having adequate B9 in the body. If you start taking B9, say 2 months into pregnancy, well, the spinal cord's already developed at that point. So this is a completely preventable birth defect called spina bifida, and it can be prevented by simply having enough vitamin B9 in the body. So, grocery shop, almost every cereal advertises on the front nowadays that they have, you know, 100% of your daily requirement of folic acid, and of course that's because we need it as females to make spinal cords develop in fetuses. This is a spina bifida case. You notice that the spinal cord actually is not inside the spine. It is protruded out, it's not protected, and in many cases, everything from the point here down toward the buttocks, those motor control is impaired. So the person is born with disabilities with holding urine, being incontinent, you know, with feces, leg motor control, and so it's a completely preventable birth defect just based on B9 presence in the bloodstream. So there's how it kind of buckles out. They can repair that at birth, but it doesn't repair the loss of motor skills. We know a lot about B12. We've talked about this one numerous times. Why is this one important? Red blood cells, good. Needed for red blood cells. It is also an important one for nervous system functions, just like B9. We already know about intrinsic factor. It's made in your stomach. It helps us absorb it in the small intestines. Bacteria in the large intestines also help make us a vitamin B12 and help us absorb it too. We've talked about this one. This particular vitamin comes from animal products, so those who are vegetarians are not going to get the B12 from the animal products, so they may need a supplement, which of course should be taken with food. We already know the deficiency here is pernicious anemia. How about questions so far?
Don't touch
it. Okay. I was waiting for heads to stop bobbing. Anyone still need the slide? Okay, the last one, vitamin C, is a really interesting story. Back in the 1940s, a scientist named Linus Pauling did some research and said, hey, vitamin C is great for immune function. It helps to improve your immune system. It helps you to fight off things that you come in contact with. So nowadays, what do you see on the shelves for people who are sick? Vitamin C. You know, they have the airborne stuff. They have all these different products that contain vitamin C. They have done numerous studies since the 1940s to support Linus Pauling's study, and they can't support it. So they conclude that vitamin C really isn't that important for immune function. Nonetheless, what do we reach for? Vitamin C enriched products. So for, you know, 70, going on 80 years here, we have this notion that vitamin C is important for immune function. In reality, it's needed for collagen synthesis. Collagen is one of those proteins that helps form numerous connective tissues. It's extremely important in helping to hold your body together. And so that's where we really see the role for vitamin C. We do get vitamin C from everything from juices like orange juice and lemon juice to citrus fruits and potatoes. And unfortunately, if you don't have enough vitamin C, your collagen fibers begin to fail, and we can't make new ones, and so scurvy, known as Barlow's disease, can result. So if you've ever watched the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and been disgusted at their teeth, that's scurvy, okay? So the teeth begin to fall out, there is not enough collagen to hold them in their sockets, and all those sailors needed to carry with them was a load of potatoes or citrus fruit, and that would have given them the vitamin C that they need. So simple solution, they just didn't know it back then. Sometimes people with scurvy also get little red dots on their body surface. That's erythema here. That can come along with it. And then corkscrew hairs can also form. It has something to do with the lack of collagen down in the deeper layers of the skin. So kind of some strange side effects here of scurvy, but again, a completely preventable disease if you can absorb vitamin C into your bloodstream. All right, so that does the tour of vitamins. How about questions so far? Don't worry about the food groups. I'm not going to ask you those on test day. I would focus instead on whether it's fat-soluble or water-soluble, why you need it, and any deficiencies listed there by name. So don't worry about the food sources. Just wanted to mention for those who came in after our discussion, we talked early on in class today about moving the test from Monday to Wednesday, give you guys a little extra time. So instead of break, is that good? Okay. Well, good. I don't know if that was a good look or a bad look. So what we're going to do instead of review today is we'll say review for Monday. I'm just going to keep working on urinary system so we don't get behind. And then Monday we'll do a little urinary and probably some big review on Monday. Okay, so do bring your questions on Monday. All right, so the test on Wednesday of next week only works us to page 102. Page 103 starts the urinary system. That's going to be chapter 24. 24 and 25 are going to be covered on test number 4, so don't worry about these for next week's test. I will also move back your quiz dates on D2L. That way you'll have some extra time to go up there and take those.
Miss Tanner, do we need to know the 20 essential, like the proteins?
Oh, I wouldn't worry about those, yeah. They're kind of just an FYI. Okay, so we're going to look on page 103 for the urinary system. That's where we're going to be starting. I'll go through the rest of the main content on Monday, but I'll leave you at least 45 minutes on Monday to do review. So, of course, the gallbladder and the urinary bladder, we have to be specific when we talk about these because when we say bladder, there's actually two, gallbladder and urinary bladder, and in fact, both can be dealt with the blow of stones. Gallstones can affect the gallbladder, and of course, kidney stones can affect the urinary bladder. So, you know, just something to kind of think about there, that there are two bladders in the body, and if we don't specify, then, you know, we may leave someone confused. In terms of urinary anatomy, we're going to start there on the top of page 103. The urinary system is really simple. You've got two kidneys, two ureters, a bladder, and a urethra. And this system is very important for helping us remove waste products. These are metabolic waste products that end up in your bloodstream, waste products that are nitrogen-containing waste. So, yes, of course, feces get rid of waste products through your digestive system, but we're talking about removing waste from our bloodstream to remove through your urinary system. Another major function there is to maintain the composition of blood. That includes blood pH, that includes blood pressure. So the urinary system greatly contributes to regulation and maintenance of blood pH and blood pressure. And then finally, we know EPO is made by the kidneys. What is EPO good for? Red blood cell production, right? So we've got to include that in our conversation as well. In terms of overall anatomy, you'll notice there are two kidneys here that are not situated equal to each other in terms of position. You'll notice that this one here on the left is situated a little higher, the one on the right a little lower. Why the difference in their position? Liver, yeah. Liver's so big, it pushes down on that right kidney, and so it's a little lower in the anatomy than the left kidney is sitting there. Each kidney is sitting under the last part of your ribs. You know, it's situated against the back part of your body wall, and they're only held there by connective tissues and fat. So there's not any bone or any muscle supporting them against your back body wall. Each kidney is about the size of a bath bar of soap, around 4 to 5 inches in length. And so let's talk about how they're anchored in place. So each kidney has on top an adrenal gland. Each kidney has a medial indentation right there where vessels and nerves come and go. But what we're really looking at is the fascia and connective tissue that anchors them to the body. There's, you'll notice on your sheet, a fibrous capsule, a fat capsule, and a layer of fascia, and that is it that anchors your kidney to your back. So any kind of jarring or damage that can displace your kidneys, they will slide in their little pouches down the back part of your body wall. So unfortunately, if that happens, what happens to the ureter that leads away there? If your kidneys start to slide, your ureter will kink. And if your ureter kinks and bends, what happens to the urine in it? It's stuck, yes. You can't get the urine to go to the bladder. And where does it back up? To the kidney, yes. So unfortunately, you know, we don't want to get damage along our backs because that can cause damage to the kidneys and make them prolapse and slide. Let's cut open a kidney and talk about the regions on the inside. There are three primary regions: an outer cortex, a medulla, and then a pelvis region. So if you think about the kidney like a piece of fruit, kind of a likely thought, right? If you peel off this outer region here, this brown layer, that's going to be taking off that capsule on the outside. That leaves us with this layer right through here that we call what? Cortex, good. The cortex also includes these renal columns in between the pyramids. Those renal columns are also made up of renal cortex tissue. So even though the columns are not on the outside layer, they're still considered cortical tissue. What type of region do these pyramids belong to? Mandula. Mandula, good. So they're the middle layer. And then where should we locate the renal pelvis? Yeah, that basin right there is your renal pelvis. And what collects there? Urine, good. Urine collects in that basin called the renal pelvis. The renal pelvis then lets urine travel down the ureter. It's held in the bladder until you expel it. And of course, it travels out the urethra at that point. So from superficial too deep, you've got cortex, medulla or medulla, and then that basin-like renal pelvis. Let's talk about the calyces. This is probably a better picture here. There are minor calyces and major calyces. So when urine is made, urine drips from the tips of these renal pyramids. Those tips are called papilla. The urine drips into a little grooved area right there that we call what? Minor calyx, yeah. So the minor calyx is going to pick up urine, and when you come out, you get into a larger area where two minors join. That's now called a major calyx. Now, this is kind of weird, but the way they discovered this is they worked their way backwards. They said where the renal pelvis splits, those are the majors, and where the majors split, those are the minors. So the way they actually named this is working in the opposite direction. But nonetheless, when we're thinking of urine flow, urine flows from the papilla to the minor calyces to the major calyces to the renal pelvis to the what? Ureter is good. And then for storage in the bladder, right. So when we're thinking of it in flow path of urine, that's really the best way to look at it, is minors to the majors to the pelvis to the ureter and then down to the bladder. So in fact, that is on the very bottom of your page. That is a part of a pathway of urine flow. So you want to highlight that, because for test four, we'll come back and talk about that particular pathway. How about questions so far? You all have worked with this in lab? Today, okay. So I know in the lab next door, we have some little kidney models about this big, and on those kidney models, these, you'll notice these little white squiggly lines. And you may just overlook them and not think much about them, but those are nephrons. Each kidney has about 1 million nephrons, and that is the functional and structural unit of the kidney. That is where we filter blood and make urine. So that's what those little squiggly white lines are. They weren't somebody having a fun time with some white out or a white pencil. They are representative nephrons. In reality, this is what a nephron looks like. It is a squiggly little tube, and this tube is going to filter your blood, return the good stuff back to your bloodstream, and take the bad stuff and dump it into your urine. So 1 million of these in each kidney means we're pretty efficient at processing our blood. We do so a couple hundred times a day. Every day, these kidneys and their nephrons are filtering this blood for us. So I'd like to talk you through the two parts of the kidneys, nephrons. You'll notice on your sheet, the two main portions are number one, a renal corpuscle, and number two, a renal tubule. Okay, a renal corpuscle and a renal tubule. By the way, you've got a bigger picture over on page 111. So if that one's too tiny to look at, there's a big one on 111. Okay, so this entire structure is called the nephron. I'd like to help you label this if you want to on page 111 with the parts. We're going to start off with the renal corpuscle first, which includes two parts, a glomerulus and a capsule. So we're going to look down here at this knot. This little knot of capillaries is called the glomerulus or the glomerulocapillaries. You can call it glomerulus or the glomerulocapillaries, your choice. Are going to be important because they filter the blood. They are the site of filtration in your nephron. So we'll come back and talk more about how they're structured on the next page. When you filter blood, you've got to capture it, and that blood is captured by a capsule, and we call that capsule a glomerular capsule, or you can call it the older name, which is Bowman's capsule. They're trying to get away from naming stuff after people, so you're noticing that instead of calling stuff by somebody's name, like Bowman, we're trying to call it by what it actually is, and it's a glomerular capsule. So this piece that surrounds right around there, that is our capsule.
the capillaries are in a renal capsule. Yeah, because they're always going to be situated inside that capsule.
Right, inside the big.
Inside the big one, yeah. Did I understand you right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Because you're saying all that stuff is in the renal capsule.
Or corpuscle. Yeah, those are the two parts of the corpuscle, the capillaries and then the capsule surrounding it. Now let's talk about the rest of the nephron. The rest of it is called a renal tubule, and the tubule here is composed of three primary parts. The first portion is this squiggly part here called the PCT. That stands for the proximal convoluted tubule. Once you travel through the PCT, or proximal convoluted tubule, you head down a descending limb and then back up an ascending limb of the nephron loop. The old name for it is loop of Henle. Then where do you go? DCT, yeah. Distal convoluted tubule is next. Some textbooks say the collecting tube or collecting duct, I put it up here as CT, is part of the renal tubule. Some say it's not. We'll include it as part of it. And you'll notice these little knobs here. These are DCTs of other nephrons that use that same collecting tube. So they're all dumping urine into that same collecting tube. Let me give you a bigger perspective, because when you look at one of those kidney models and you see renal pyramids, these renal pyramids are of course triangular in shape, and you'll notice a lot of them have these lines that are running down toward the renal tip. Those lines are the collecting ducts collecting urine from numerous nephrons, and they're all going to be pointing here at this tip of the renal papilla. So I just want to kind of give you perspective for how this fits into those renal pyramids.
So the lines that we see in the renal pyramids are really a bunch of nephron loops?
Yeah, nephron loops and collecting ducts, and you know, they're all pointing toward that tip, so that's what you're looking at, is parts of those nephrons. That's right. How about so far so good? You got any questions so far? So, in reality, your nephron does not sit drawn out straight like you see here. As a space-saving measure, it's actually going to exist like this. So if you could wrap it up and let it give itself a hug, that's how nephrons actually exist. So if you notice, when we coil this thing up, that glomerulus there is going to sit actually up against the DCT. Now, if you flow with the urine and the fluids traveling through here, technically PCT is closer to your corpuscle,
you know, if you follow it and trace it, DCT is further from your corpuscle as you would flow through this thing. But, you know, the weird thing is when you kind of wrap it up in a circle, that DCT is going to butt right up against that renal corpuscle. I'd like to show you what that looks like. Before we go there, do you have any questions on what we've labeled so far? So on your paper there, about halfway down the page, you'll notice something called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. That's page 104 in the middle. And what you're looking at is a renal corpuscle. What are the two parts of a renal corpuscle? Good. There's your glomerulus, there's your Bowman's capsule. Together they make up the renal corpuscle, and this is the place where you filter blood. If your job in the kidney is to filter blood, you've got to have enough force behind that blood to push it out. I know this is going to go back into our earlier course materials, but what type of pressure is going to push blood?
Hydrostatic,
good. So you've got to have a great enough push or hydrostatic pressure to effectively filter the blood through these glomerular capillaries. If you have any blood pressure issues, low blood pressure especially, you're not going to be able to force that fluid out of those capillary walls. So you'll notice that sitting right here between these arterioles that feed and drain the glomerulus, there's a triangular region of cells. Those cells are called the juxtaglomerular apparatus, or the JGA for short. It is their job to detect blood pressure and regulate it if there's any problems. So these JGA cells are going to release a chemical called renin if you have low blood pressure. So I know you've heard of renin before, right? Okay. So this is back to our old story. If you happen to have low blood pressure, you can't filter blood and make urine. That means you can't get rid of your waste products. So those JGA cells turn on the release of renin. Renin then travels to the liver. This is old story, right? The liver makes angiotensin 1. ACE converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. And then aldosterone and ADH are secreted. So let's add to this story. We've been here all this stuff before. Is all of this familiar to you? Okay. So when aldosterone is secreted, let me take you back to this picture. Aldosterone comes to the DCT, there it sits, and aldosterone inserts sodium channels. What gets reabsorbed into the bloodstream?
Sodium.
And what follows sodium?
Water.
Yeah, so sodium, of course, brings along water. And now what impact have we made on the blood pressure? Raise it up. So right here, next door in that JGA area, they're checking to make sure that that blood pressure is actually correct. So that JGA is going to say, yep, good job, you've got enough sodium and water reabsorbed, blood pressure is back to normal. What can we now start doing here in your glomerulus?
Filtration,
yeah. So we can continue pushing out the blood, filtering the bad, keeping the good. So the JGA cells are the ones that monitor blood pressure, turn on renin, and then aldosterone comes full circle to that DCT and inserts sodium channels. What happens if you have high blood pressure? Do you turn on the release of renin? No. Yeah, what would that do to you? Raise it even more. Yeah, so if you've got high blood pressure, there is no need for the renin-angiotensin mechanism. It is shut off by high blood pressure, high sodium, or high water levels in the bloodstream. So this is a mechanism turned on by low blood pressure. That is our primary stimulus here. So why do we need this mechanism? What does it help ensure that we can do?
Filter our blood.
Filter our blood, right. And why is it so important that we filter the blood?
pH.
Get rid of waste. Blood pressure. Yeah. And so if you can't filter your blood, you have problems modifying blood pH, getting rid of waste products, perhaps issues with blood pressure. So, yeah, we've got to make sure that we can get rid of those bad items, waste products, and reclaim the good that we want to put back in the blood.
Do
Okay. How about questions on renin angiotensin? So I promised you in here in the early part of the semester we'd come full circle, and here we are. This is finally the time where we've come back around to angiotensin and how it plays a role with this whole mechanism, renin angiotensin mechanism. All right, bottom of your page there, you've got two nephrons. That's bottom of page 104. Nephrons are typically classified as cortical or as juxtamedullary. So the name tells you where they're located. Where are the cortical nephrons? Cortex, yeah. Is that the outer region or is that the pyramid region?
Outer region,
yeah. So way up top here, you'll notice these cortical nephrons. Look at their short nephron loops and compare that to the juxtamedullary nephron. It sits on the kind of the boundary between the cortex and the medulla, and you'll notice it has such an incredibly long nephron loop. So does that nephron loop make a difference here in what you can do? Yeah, absolutely. That nephron loop is where you can reabsorb fluids. The longer the nephron loop, the more fluids you can reabsorb, and the more concentrated the urine you make. The shorter the nephron loop, the less time you have to reabsorb fluids, and the more dilute urine you're going to make. So these lengths here actually dictate what type of fluid or what type of urine we're going to make. So that's actually detailed down there for you on the bottom of the page. In fact, 80% of your cortical nephrons are, and 85% are in fact cortical nephrons. Do you have any questions on the locations of these or what type of urine they produce? Okay, let's see. Instead of getting you guys into blood flow, let's just do that a little bit on Monday. Like I said, I'll save you 45 minutes for open conversation on Monday, and then we'll pick up with urinary after you finish that test the following week. All right, so just to repeat, we have no test Monday. The test is Wednesday. If anybody needs to take it early, let me know.